Hello, I'm Rachel Marshall, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit. Welcome to the monthly roundup from the Cochrane Library. The July 2011 issue includes 40 updated reviews and 39 new reviews, four of which are featured later in this roundup, examining interventions on the care of older people, osteoporosis, malaria, and heart disease. Also on the Cochrane Library this month are two editorials debating the role of invasive placebo controls in randomised trials. Alan Siner and colleagues at the University of Adelaide, Australia, argue that trials using invasive placebo controls are unethical and should be excluded from Cochrane reviews. On the other hand, David Kalmas from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, USA, believes that invasive placebo controls are ethical and indeed that the exclusion of studies that use invasive placebos from systematic reviews may in itself pose serious harm. Both of these editorials are available as podcasts and can be accessed from the editorial pages of the Cochrane Library. We have also added a new section to the library's browse menu, highlighting reviews of complementary and alternative medicine. You'll find this on the left-hand side of the homepage, and it allows you to navigate quickly through the topics covered in the Cochrane database of systematic reviews. This new complementary and alternative medicine section includes over 400 reviews, covering a broad range of clinical conditions, including cancer, asthma, and rheumatoid arthritis. We'll hear first from Graham Ellis from Monkland Hospital in Airdrie, Scotland. Graham describes the findings of a new Cochrane review assessing the effects of comprehensive geriatric assessment for older adults admitted to hospital.
Increasing numbers of older adults are being admitted to hospital as an emergency, and many of them have complex, overlapping health conditions and may present in an atypical fashion with acute disability, functional decline, or confusion. This requires a different approach to healthcare for older adults coming into hospital. It must be multidimensional, simultaneously looking at medical, cognitive, psychological, and functional domains. It needs to be multidisciplinary, bringing different disciplines together to solve overlapping problems. And it must be coordinated, involving both treatment and rehabilitation. This approach has been termed Comprehensive Geriatric Assessment, or CGA for short. In a hospital, it can be delivered in a dedicated ward space, a geriatric ward that patients are admitted to, or by a peripatetic liaison team visiting patients in a general ward setting. We embarked on this review to find out if this form of care was better than routine care, and after working through 22 trials involving more than 10,000 patients across six countries, it's fairly clear that it is. We found that patients who received CGA were more likely to be alive and in their own homes at the end of follow-up, usually 12 months, than those cared for in a general medical setting. They were less likely to end up in a nursing home, suffer death or deterioration, and were more likely to have better cognition at follow-up. The results were striking and consistent. There was, however, a subtle but important difference when we compared wards and teams. It seemed that despite the assumptions in the previous literature that both wards and teams were beneficial, the overall benefits seemed to arise from trials of CGA wards, while the CGA teams tended at times towards harm. We also looked at which patients might benefit most, those fitting predetermined criteria, the frailer group, or those taken on the basis of an age cutoff, irrespective of their frailty. Whilst there are limitations to what we could say, what seemed to emerge is that it mattered more where you were admitted than who was admitted. All groups of patients appeared to benefit to some degree from admission to CGA wards and not from CGA teams. We also looked at costs, and whilst we couldn't perform meta-analysis, many of the trials reported that CGA was less costly than usual care, especially when the costs of nursing home care are included. Taking all of this evidence together, the results of our review have huge potential significance for healthcare providers to reduce the burden of illness and disability for the older population admitted to hospital, perhaps even at reduced cost.
One of the early Cochrane reviews published on the Cochrane Library in the late 1990s looked at the effects of exercise on osteoporosis in postmenopausal women. Tracy Howe from Glasgow Caledonian University in the UK joined the author team for the most recent update of this review, and she discusses the latest results.
The high prevalence and staggering costs of osteoporotic-related fractures in postmenopausal women means prevention and management of this disease is important. Exercise is one of the non-pharmacological options available, and there continues to be much interest in its effects on bone. The extensive updating of this Cochrane review reveals that exercise improves bone mineral density slightly and slightly reduces the chances of having a fracture. Osteoporosis increases the risk of fractures because it reduces the density of bone tissue. Such fractures can lead to death and produce much morbidity, including chronic pain, a reduction in quality of life, and admission to long-term care, as well as considerable health and social care costs. The most common osteoporotic fractures are at the hip, spinal vertebrae, or wrist. The prevention of fractures is the primary goal of interventions for osteoporosis. In general, it's thought that prolonged periods of inactivity and unloading of the skeleton promotes reduced bone mass. With this in mind, various exercise interventions have been described and evaluated, with the intention of stimulating bone growth and preserving bone mass. Therefore, this Cochrane review sets out to examine the effects of exercise interventions in preventing bone loss and fractures in postmenopausal women. We considered all randomized trials of exercise in healthy postmenopausal women and have included 43 studies with over 4,300 participants. 27 of the trials are included for the first time in this update. The trials all compared some form of exercise with a package of care that did not include the specific exercise intervention. Overall, the quality of reporting of studies was low. In particular, we found potential problems with how the randomization was done. The fact that people involved in the trials were aware of which randomized group the woman was in, and lost to follow-up. The meta-analyses revealed slight improvements in bone mineral density and slight reductions in fractures among women in the exercise group. Compared with the control groups who did not exercise, the most effective type of exercise program on bone mineral density for the neck of femur appears to be non-weight-bearing high-force exercise, such as progressive resistance strength training for the lower limbs, with a 1% smaller reduction in bone mineral density. The most effective exercise program for bone mineral density at the spine was a combination of different types of exercises, which produced a 3% smaller reduction. Fractures and falls were reported as adverse events in some studies, allowing us to estimate that exercise reduces the chances of having a fracture slightly. For example, from about 11 per 100 women to 7 per 100 women. In conclusion, exercise has the potential to be safe and effective way to avert bone loss in postmenopausal women. Future research needs to focus on standardized, accurate outcome measures, including fractures and fall data, better reporting of all the parameters of exercise programs, and longer-term follow-up.
The Cochrane Library has recently begun to publish a new type of review, Cochrane Diagnostic Test Accuracy Reviews. Catherine Abber from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine in the UK describes a new diagnostic test accuracy review on rapid tests for detecting malaria. An editorial on this review is also available on the library homepage.
Malaria kills hundreds of thousands of children and adults every year in the tropics. People get the disease through being bitten by a particular species of mosquito that's infected with the malaria parasite. Early treatment can prevent severe malaria and deaths, and some of the new drugs, the artemisinin combination therapies, or OCTs, have been shown to be extremely effective when properly used. The commonest symptom of malaria is fever, but in malarial areas, other causes of fever are also common, especially in children. So when a person living in a malarial area gets a fever, health workers need to know the cause to make sure that they give the right treatment. For many years in sub-Saharan Africa, where the most life-threatening P. falciparum form of malaria is also the most common, primary health workers have often assumed that a fever is caused by malaria and automatically given anti-malarial drugs. This means that people are sometimes given the wrong treatment for their illness. It also wastes resources and over time can promote resistance to the anti-malarial drugs. The World Health Organization now strongly recommends that health staff confirm that a patient has malaria before they give treatment. Up until recently, this was done by examining a patient's blood with microscopy for parasites. However, this requires highly trained staff, chemicals and equipment, all of which are in short supply in many areas where malaria is common. Rapid diagnostic tests, on the other hand, are more recently developed tests designed to be easy to use in many settings. They detect P. falciparum malaria by using carefully manufactured molecules or antibodies which bind to the malaria parasites in an infected patient's blood, triggering a colour change on a test strip that can be easily seen with the naked eye. Moving from no diagnostic tests or from the older microscopy tests to the newer rapid diagnostic tests can mean a major shift in practice for health workers, and it's not as easy as it may seem to adopt. To inform this shift in practice, we conducted this systematic review to examine the accuracy of rapid diagnostic tests compared with the older microscopy tests. After looking at available data from 74 different studies, we found that these antigen detecting tests will correctly identify 19 out of 20 cases of P. falciparum malaria. There are various rapid diagnostic tests available, and all of the tests reviewed perform reasonably well. But there are still some uncertainties about how easy the tests are to use and also what barriers there may be to using them. Further research had helped to address these issues, but it's now clear that the use of rapid diagnostic tests is another step towards reaching the goal of universal accuracy in the diagnosis of malaria. They are key to ensuring that the right treatment is given to patients, which will lead to resources savings and reduce the pressure on drug resistance.
The links between diet and heart disease have been explored by many researchers. The latest update of a Cochrane review brings together a large amount of evidence on saturated fats. Robin Dara of Loughborough University spoke with the lead reviewer, Lee Hooper, from the University of East Anglia in the UK about the research and its implications.
Hello Lee, this is clearly a substantial topic for a review. When you began, what were you trying to find out?
Well, we were interested in understanding the effects on the heart and on the cardiovascular health of reducing saturated fat, that's animal fats, in the diet, and looking at events such as heart attacks, angina, strokes, sudden cardiovascular death, and the need for heart surgery. We also wanted to explore ways of reducing saturated fats. So, for example, the energy lost from reducing saturated fat can be replaced from starchy foods, which reduces the total fat intake of the diet, which creates a low-fat diet. Or alternatively, saturated fats can be replaced by unsaturated fats, that's polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats, so that the total amount of fat in the diet isn't reduced. We call this a modified fat diet, and we look for studies that looked at both approaches.
How much research did you find?
Well, in the latest review, we found 48 large randomized controlled trials with over 65,000 men and women, doubling what we had in the previous version of the review. Some of the people in the trials already had cardiovascular disease or were at increased risk of cardiovascular disease, and others were at low risk. The participants maintained their eating patterns for at least 6 months, but many of the studies ran for much longer than that, many years.
When you brought this research together, what did it show?
Well, we've got two main findings. There are no clear health benefits of reducing the total amount of fat we eat when we replace the saturated fats with starchy foods. But modifying the fat in our food by replacing some of the saturated or animal fats with plant oils and unsaturated spreads may reduce the risk of heart and vascular disease. But it's not clear whether monounsaturated or polyunsaturated fats are the more beneficial replacement fats.
How long do you need to modify your fat intake for to gain these benefits on cardiovascular events?
Well, the protection seems to come if we adhere to the modified fat diet for at least 2 years. We need to see modifying fat intake as a long-term way of eating to improve our health.
Did any of the results you came up with surprise you?
Yes, we were surprised that there was such a clear difference between the effects of a low-fat diet, reducing saturated fat and replacing lost energy by starchy foods, and a modified fat diet, where the saturated fat is reduced and the energy replaced by other types of fat. The main theory has always been that eating saturated fat raises your LDL or bad cholesterol, which increases our risk of cardiovascular diseases via atherosclerosis or furrowing up of the blood vessels. So this should make the effects of a low-fat diet and a modified fat diet very similar. However, we've clearly shown that modified fat diets appear to be more effective in reducing the risk of cardiovascular events than low-fat diets, despite the fact that both are reducing their saturated fat intakes. So this could be due to a low-fat diet being harder to maintain and so less effective, but that's not clear.
As well as the difference between the different diets, is there a difference between their effect in different people?
Well, yes, the first thing to say is there's no clear difference in effect for people at high risk of cardiovascular disease and those in the general population. So the data suggests that we would all benefit to some extent from replacing saturated fats with other fats, polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats, for at least 2 years, but not by moving to a lower fat diet. The difficulty is the data are unclear for women. The data suggests that women do not benefit as much as men, but there are no trials of over 2 years that modify fat in women and report cardiovascular events. The data are quite clear about the benefits of modifying fat in men and reducing saturated fats and replacing them with mono or polyunsaturated fats, but the equivalent trials just haven't been carried out yet in women, so we can't tell the exact effect in women.
To sum up, how big is the reduction in the risk of cardiovascular events from a modified fat diet?
The average effects from studies in which the participants reduced their saturated fat intake for at least 2 years are reductions in cardiovascular events of around 20%, meaning that modifying dietary fat for at least 2 years is a really good public health strategy. So, for example, if 10 out of 100 people would have a cardiovascular event if they stayed on their normal diet, switching to a modified fat diet for at least 2 years would lower this to 8 out of 100 people.
You can read all the featured Cochrane reviews and the other new and updated Cochrane reviews in the July issue at thecochranelibrary.com. I hope you've enjoyed the podcasts, and thank you for listening to this July roundup of the Cochrane Library.